do begin.
Hey, what is up, guys, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. Today, my guest is Viva Padilla. She is the editor-in-chief of the literary journal Dryland, which is now, I believe, approaching its fifth anniversary. And we have the poet and author of Mowing Leaves of Grass, Matt Cedillo. Now, both of these very interesting individuals were able to join me on the conversation this time to talk about their most recent experience in Cuba as they visited early last year, or late last year, I believe, to basically showcase their work at Casas de las Americas. For the most part, we went ahead and just talked about how important it is to be consistent in your work and how not to be easily discouraged when you don't see things moving fast enough for you. As a reminder for anybody is that a lot of the experiences that we have, a lot of the things that we're looking to do aren't going to be done overnight. And it's a cycle. You know, you have to go through the ups and downs and you have to be consistent with the work and keep that momentum in order to get where you want to be. So I hope you guys enjoy the conversation. If you don't, then just go listen to something else. But I hope you do. I hope you guys really do give it a chance and, you know, see where things take you. Today's music is brought to you by Virgin Spirit with the song Love Nectar. It's one of their most recent releases. You can find it on Bandcamp, on YouTube, on Spotify. Check it out. You know, you're not going to regret it. You're gonna love the vibe. So just tune in, stick around, make sure you follow them. Make sure you say what's up. Say, yo, man, your song is awesome or not. But just be kind. Keep the love going. I hope you guys enjoy. Catch you later. What's up, guys, and welcome back to another episode of the Social Primate Podcast. Today we have a double guest. We have double guests today, and we have Viva Padilla and we have Matt Cedillo. What is up, guys? How you guys doing?
Hey, what's up? Doing good.
How you doing, man? Appreciate it.
Thank you guys for making this happen really last minute. We just planned it yesterday and we're here now getting it done. For the most part, again, thank you again for coming out. For those people who are like, hey, I recognize that voice, you know, we had Viva Padilla here like a year, maybe like a little less than a year on the podcast.
Yeah, it was like late last year, I think.
Yeah, late last year. So, I mean, again, you know, we're in all these crazy times now, but, you know, you guys are still doing your thing and I'm still doing my thing. And I guess I think that's what really matters. But thank you guys again. And if you guys want to fill in the people listening in terms of what you guys do, Viva, you don't need too much introduction, but I'd still love to get a little bit of information from you for our listeners.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me on your show again. I love it here. And this is different from what I'm used to. I'm usually in a room with you, smoking a blunt or smoking a joint or whatever, just hanging out. And this is nice too. It's kind of weird, but this is what we're all doing now, right? Yeah. The Zoom. Well, things are good. I'm running the journal. So I'm a editor-in-chief of a literary journal that started in South Central, and we're on our fifth year. We publish poetry, fiction, nonfiction, art. And yeah, that's most of what I do. I'm also a poet. I perform in different spaces, different places. I collaborate with different people, including Matt Cedillo, which is one of the few people that I collaborate with. And yeah, that's me.
Well, what about you, Matt? I know, you know, you have a really, how can I say it, a celebrated background, I would say, based on what I've seen online, you know. And, you know, again, thank you for taking the time to actually make this happen as well. I know you mentioned you're a poet and author. Do you mind going a little bit of deep in how you got into this area of, I guess, life?
Yeah. Well, then again, you know, again, thank you for having me on. So most recently I come up with this new book, Mowing Leaves of Grass, which is published by Flower Song Press. So I'm very excited about my latest collection. in terms of poet and author, just I've been around for probably a little over a decade now. Just started just doing open mics, and then an open mics of the feature to touring locally, to touring nationally, to where things are at now. So we're where things are at now, which is that able to speak at universities and tour internationally at this point. So it's pretty exciting.
Damn, that's good. And I mean, for you, how has that process been over the last decade or so? Like, I'm pretty sure you didn't start off with like a whole group of base of people, knowing who you were, and obviously you had to climb to that status. How has that been for you personally?
Well, for me personally, it's been fantastic. I mean, I didn't really get into this until I was in my mid to late 20s. Well, how old would you consider 26? Would that be your mid 20s?
Yeah.
End of your mid 20s? It's like the tail end of your mid 20s, right? Where you start steering down 30. So I didn't really get started until I was 26. So like it was not terribly old, but also not like some of the, especially if you're doing like spoken word type stuff, not terribly young either. So I mean, you have to think that the Youth Slam was really big at that time. So it's like 16-year-olds, 19-year-olds, whatever. So I kind of started that. And before that, when I look back at my life, I was always like one of the people that was like kind of, one of the smarter or funnier or more interesting or more whatever of my little peer groups, right? But that's all I ever was, right? And I always felt like I had something inside of me that I wanted to share with the world, and I would never get out. I would never have a chance to share it. And I was just, I was struggling with alcoholism at the time. And I struggled with alcoholism for a while, actually, even after I got started. But it was really this kind of like this real anger and frustration with the fact that like I was doing this, and I was also like working these jobs that I really hated, and I would think that like I'm gonna die, and my grave will read, "Here lies a man who folded shirts," and "Here lies a man who supervised, who worked his way up to supervise other people to wash shirt, to fold shirts," right? And that was kind of like how I felt about my life. And it wasn't until later, when I started finding this artistic outlet, that even when I was still working, I had a different way of viewing myself, because I was viewed differently by at least a couple hundred people, knew who I was, right? In a local scene, like, oh, that's Mancidio. He's going to come up, he's going to do like some poetry, and it's going to be historic, right? And so having that perception of me from people out there, it really kind of, it kind of validated all these things I was feeling about myself, that like, I have something to say, I have abilities, I have skills, I I'm an artist waiting to get out. But there was a lot of like, I was also very negative, kind of very like glasses half empty kind of guy at the time before that, or just the kind of, but it's not for me, it'll never be for me, and there's all these reasons why it's not for me. And I can never get in. But once I found my way in, I felt like hell to stay. So that's kind of within a very short period of time, I got my first book published. For What I Might Do Tomorrow was published like within like 4 months of me doing poetry. I made a slam team within 3 months of being in the scene, and I ended up going to travel to Florida to compete at the National Poetry Slam. And so like that kind of like opened my eyes to what was possible. I kind of just really kind of like always try to progress every year, doing something bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And so it resulted in like in 2017, I was on C-SPAN, right? In 2018, nice. I spoke at Cambridge. In 2019, me, Ana, and Elmi Viva, and Iris Dianda, and Luis Rodriguez spoke at Casa de las Americas in Havana, Cuba. So it's always like every year, even if it's kind of like parallel, it's not necessarily going up, it's like at least equivalent. I always have to make sure that every year something big happens, something like really big, something just really just like, something with a wow factor happens every year.
Yeah.
And you add enough of those up.
You add enough of those up.
You add enough of those up, and then you have your name.
Damn, that's cool. I mean, I think it's cool, because I've had the chance to talk to Viva a few times. I know when, like she mentioned herself, when everything started with Dryland, it was, if correct me if I'm wrong, it was based like South Central, like LA, this area that for the most part, when people think or hear South Central, they think violence, they think gangs, they think, African Americans or Hispanics, and like just there's all like this negativity attached to just the word South Central. So, when I first heard that, I was like, damn, like this looks like it's something that somebody's like, she's tapping into an area that doesn't necessarily have this hype around it, and trying to lift these people who are trying to find a way to voicing themselves. And for you, Matt, you're from like Del Sereno area, right? Where is that located? Is that like considered like East LA?
Oh, I think you
Recently,
did.
there was an incident in recently there was this thing in El Sereno where during this the you know during the pandemic where people were seizing houses, right? Because Caltrans had you know been holding these homes like hostage essentially for many years, for decades, for literally most of my life, and they took it, and it was kind of funny because it became a national story, you know, that they were seizing these homes and putting people in them, and they kept referring it to it as Northeast LA, Northeast LA, Northeast LA. So that is not Northeast LA. That is El Sereno. Right? That's very it's its own place. It's probably I would describe it as probably the northernmost tip of what would be described as historically the East Side. So that would be like, you know, like El Sereno, Boyle Heights, City Terrace, Lincoln Heights, and of course East LA, right? If you ask some people where the East Side is, they'll tell you it's only Boyle Heights and East LA. Those people are from Boyle Heights. If you ask some people, they'll tell you that the East Side is only East LA, and those people are from East LA. But but a lot of people would recognize, even LA Times, with the LA Times mapping project, recognizes the East Side as El Sereno, Boyle Heights, Lincoln Heights, City Terrace, and East LA. So that's where it is, kind of that, in that the general kind of area. But it's also the city that kind of peaks into the San Gabriel Valley, right? So growing up, that was kind of an interesting experience because, you know, you always go to a place, Charlie's Trio, which is like a pizza restaurant, an Italian restaurant. And it's technically, I think technically it's in Alhambra, but like that, those kind of like dividing line. You go past there, you end up in South Pasadena. But then you go right, you end up in Alhambra. And those are like kind of very different worlds. I mean, Alhambra less than Pasadena, because Pasadena is very kind of rich white neighborhood, whereas Alhambra is more of kind of like a working class Latino and Asian neighborhood, but slightly more Asian. And working class in comparison to like richer neighborhoods, but it's definitely more well off than El Sereno, right? And so that was kind of always an interesting thing because my mom always wanted to take me to like quality libraries. And so we would go to the library in LA, you know, downtown LA, which obviously huge. Whenever we go to the one in Pasadena, you know, that was really big. But the one we went most often to was the one in Alhambra, right? Because it was closest. It was good, and the one in El Sereno wasn't that good at the time. El Sereno now has a really great library, but they didn't really have the time. So I always remember going to Alhambra to go to the library. So that's a little bit different than I think people that would live in different neighborhoods. So it's kind of it's an interesting place that it peaks right into the San Gabriel Valley, but it's still part of the East Side. So go up with a certain kind of consciousness with that. So I don't know.
Damn. Well, I mean, it's cool because technically, you both of you guys have different, again, quote unquote, experiences of, I guess, the LA, you know, LA's divided into a bunch of different. I'm from like where you consider the Southeast LA. I'm in the city of Cudahy. So, like, more like Vernon, Commerce, close to area. So, it's more like, it's still working class for sure, but it's definitely more like factories, more like, you know, meat packing shit, you know, all these different things.
And my dad had joint custody though, so I also lived in Maywood.
Oh, nice. You know, so it's
Yeah, I don't get along
cool.
with that, so I don't bring it up. But yes, I remember the fact that, and I actually lived in a part of Maywood where you can actually see it. I mean, you can actually see this little apartment building that actually is the 100 residents that live in Vernon.
Oh, damn. All the people that, yeah, who work
Because
from.
there's only 100 people that live in Vernon, so they keep the city incorporated. So it's like a scheme. And there's like, they all have like Mercedes or whatever. And I don't think they even live there. But like, that's a way so the city can, they can stay incorporated. But like that was always like, what is that? And it wasn't until later that I was looking at these mapping LA projects, I figured out like, oh my God, that was like, those guys are the people that live in Vernon and make like $100,000 a year. And there's only like 80 of them. Like, and that's them. Like, oh, okay.
So now, like, with you guys having basically like these two different paths, at what point did you guys, you mentioned you guys, I guess, went to Cuba, right? To what was it, like a sort of event? Was it like a, can you guys like reiterate on that? Like, what was that necessarily? Like, is that where you guys first met in Cuba or
Oh,
are?
that would have been dope if we would have met in Cuba. But no, we didn't meet in Cuba. We actually met like, what was it, like maybe 10 years ago, Matt? I think it might have been 10, 8 or 10 years ago when I was running a different community magazine out of a different space. And that community magazine kind of introduced me to like some of the poetry scene, some of the art scene and things like that. And that was the first time where I saw Matt perform, and you know, a lot of the people that I know now like came out of there, or like I met there, and I was publishing poetry and things like that. Matt was there, and we met, and we just became friends. And we didn't really collaborate back then. Back then I was kind of busy doing other things. I wasn't really fully committed to running a journal yet. I was still kind of like exploring, and I was still doing internships and stuff like that at that time. But later on, I came back into the scene, and we reconnected, and then we just kind of, you know, we've always been friends. So it's kind of like we've always been connected. And and then recently we were like, yeah, let's do some things. So Matt has had an opportunity to go to Cuba and do some poetry over there with his homie, a professor at Cal State Dominguez Hills named Jose Prado. And we all kind of went. We went with him. We went with Luis Rodriguez, another poet named Iris de Anda. So it was like a bunch of us. And we went over there for like 6 days, I think, something like that. And yeah, we went over there for Latinos en los Estados Unidos. Mm-hmm. So we went over there to do like this panel where we kind of introduced our work that we do in the community. So I talked about my journal, and he talked about his work at the Daw Center. And yeah, you want to talk about it more, Matt?
Well, I mean, the only thing I would add is that we also made a documentary. We made like a little short film.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yeah. We did that before we went to Cuba. Yeah. Yeah. Whatever happened to that? Is that online that people can find?
I can put it online. I got to talk to dude. But the funny part of that is I actually had the zip drive, you know, so we put all the time.
Didn't it get wet in Cuba or something? Like he went more.
And so like the whole time lunch. I've been carrying this thing around because it's like it's like precious cargo, because it's very hard to get internet connections. So I can't pull it off the internet and like a Dropbox or something like that. So I have this thing. I'm guarding it this entire time, and we're sitting there at the hotel, and I pull it out. I'm like, okay, I have it. Like, did you bring it? I'm like, yes, I bring it. And it's like, you know, you squeeze something too hard and it like slips off your fingers for whatever. Yeah. And I pinched it and it flies up there. I'm like, oh, lands right in my coffee.
It was it was like 30 minutes before present it.
And this has been something that's been so like we poured hours and hours into this. We filmed in like four different locations. It was like we went to all the different spots we were going to be presenting on, and all the different things we were going to be talking about. We went to Tia Chucha's, we went to the Dog, we went to the Cafe, the record store to talk about Grandland. So we location changes. We had, you know, Prado, he came to every one of them and he introduced it like Robin Leach, like, you know, like, hey, we're here. And you know, like,
it was pretty great. It was pretty great.
And we got Cuban musicians to score it, and like we like all this effort.
Yeah, there was like a musical score on in the background, like all dramatic, and it was a really nice documentary. But it slipped into the coffee, and it was just we were in Cuba, we couldn't like connect. Like he said, like the internet connection over there isn't like, you know, there isn't mobile hotspots and things like that. Like you had to connect with a Wi-Fi card, and it's only for like 20, 30 minutes, and it's like the slowest Wi-Fi ever.
Like the one that rings.
No. Imagine that. No, it's not that bad. But yeah, we didn't have the means to be able to like re-upload it and stuff like that. But we managed to like really, really make an impression on the audience, on the people that were the participants, the people that were there, and also the people that run Casa de las Americas. They have invited us to do other projects with them, so we have some projects coming up with them.
Yeah.
And I was also on Cuban TV over there, Cuban National TV, which was cool, but man, that was an interesting experience.
Like for the experience in Cuba, how was that? Like, I mean, because I know from my understanding is that U.S. and Cuba relations have never been at all great. And I think it was until, I think it was Obama who passed something that basically opened up Cuba for like, I think educational like purposes or something like that. Now you said that Casa de las Americas, is that something that has been existing prior to that? Or was that something that kind of just started like developing as after those changes happened?
Casa de las Americas has been in Cuba, since the 60s. I mean, since near the since almost after the revolution. It's been around. It's been an institution there. I wish I had the information in front of me. I'll tell you who founded it. She's very famous in Cuban society. But Casa de las Americas is actually the most like prestigious.
Haide, Haide.
Oh, go ahead.
Santa Maria, Haide, Santa Maria, right?
There it is. But yeah, Casa de las Americas is the most prestigious cultural institution in Cuba. So it's, some would say, all of Latin America.
Ah, okay, okay. Now, how was that?
Feel, homie.
How was that experience for you guys? Just going there. I mean,
it was, man, I remember we showed up, like, we were, like, as soon as we got off the airplane, it was just humid. It was just like, we were just drenched in sweat. So first of all, like, the weather just hits you hard. And we were hungry. We were tired. And the first thing that we did was visit Casa de las Americas. And we got a tour of the whole place. And we were not in our right minds. I remember just feeling like so out of it and so kind of like, whoa, where am I? Yeah. So I feel like we showed up in a daze, but we kind of like still somehow like managed to like make all these things happen and like work with what was like a learning experience. Like so many things happened that we didn't know were going to happen. You know, it wasn't even just like the panel. It was like a lot of other things that were happening. So for me, I would say that like, it was kind of like, I definitely felt like I was on an island. I definitely felt like there was some voodoo in the air, like some magic in the air. I don't know. There were like all kinds of vibes. And I was like, I felt like I was high the whole time. I don't know if it was because I was dehydrated because of the humidity or something, but I was in just like mentally, I was just kind of like feeling a little high, but I loved the experience. I loved being over there and feeling like they care about our work and they're interested in what we're doing. And, you know, like it feels good to also feel supported, you know, that, you know, our beliefs are also supported, and we're not like frowned upon. Cause you know, you talk about certain things in this country and people are like, oh my God, you're talking about like, you know, you're giving away things to poor people. That's wrong. And like, oh my God, socialism. And oh my God, like that can't be done in this country. So over there, it just kind of felt nice. Like to be like, to kind of have that share that common philosophy. So there was that. That was definitely enjoyable. What about you, Matt?
Just being in Cuba, I mean, like being in Casa de las Americas was one thing, which was, you know, it's very, by the way, the film was still, we were still able to show it. So like,
It was, like without the music, right? Like there was like something.
Something went wrong, it was whatever. But I wanted to say that Casa de las Americas and Cuba are kind of like, it was one thing to go to Casa de las Americas, which was amazing because, you know, it was so prestigious. And the reason it's so prestigious is because of people that have, you know, read there and done things there. So like Roque Dalton used to have an office there, for instance. Neruda had read there. Mercedes Sosa had sang there. There's all kinds of people that had come through who were just like these just, you know, just incredible legends. Galeano had an event there in the last like decade or something. So there was, you know, all these people who had come through that were just, you know, incredibly, incredibly well-respected, world-renowned authors. And so that was really exciting to be a part of that and be.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Cuba itself, it's such an incredibly different way of doing things. There's obviously a lot of shortages, the impact of the embargo can be seen, but it's such a weird thing because like, okay, so there's like less like straws per capita.
Mm-hmm.
There's less like shoelaces per capita. There's mm-hmm. less like things per capita, right?
Yeah.
But when you go there, people don't seem to care as much. I mean, like, you know, like here, like it really made you aware that, you know, the United States of America is really a nation of Yelp reviewers. You know what I mean? Like everybody here is just like, you know, just hating.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
It's true.
And everyone always wants to like, you know, crap on like Karens and stuff like that. And yeah, Karens are the worst, but like Karen is a spectrum, man. Like most people in this country act like that. Like, you know, like, hey, I demand this and you're not going to cheat me.
Nah.
You know, like, yeah. It's not like, you know, like most people act like that. I mean, I mean, yeah, you know, like that's the way people are in this country, like for like everybody. And so like to be in Cuba is different, you know what I mean? Like people, like, you know, like the restaurant ran out something and nobody's making a scene, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you go places here, like you can tell who's the employee of the month because the hierarchy is so, we're so used to hierarchy and just like who's doing what, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Over there it's very different, you know. And I didn't see any homeless people and I didn't see the cops mess anybody up, so
yeah. Man. That was nice to see that. There was no homelessness. There was no kids in the street begging you for money and selling gum and things like that. I actually noted that there were no trash cans either on the street, but there was also no trash on the street.
Yeah.
So even that was like, whoa, like where's everybody's trash? Well, they're not using plastic. They're not using like disposables. They're just using actual cups and actual plates, and that's where wherever we would go eat, that's what we would have, actual things. And you know, that's very different because it's like you're used to going and just going from one thing to the next here in this country.
Yeah,
you know, like okay, I'm gonna go to McDonald's, okay, I'm gonna go home, pick up this, okay, and then I'm gonna go to Jack in the Box and eat this, and you're just like nonstop thinking about like what else to consume and what else to put into your body. And mm-hmm. over there, it's kind of like we're just all kind of slowed down. There was like nothing to do like that.
Damn. Yeah. That's what I meant. Like, do you think that's like an outcome because of, I guess, I don't know. I don't really know what to point towards that, but do you think that's an outcome just because of the way people live there, the way they've been, I guess, what is the word I'm trying to find here?
Well, I definitely think that there's like a difference in the value system. I mean, like we've over here, what do we value? What do they value?
Yeah.
Like we went to different bookstores, and one of the biggest things that shocked me was like being able to buy a book for like 35 cents. So I was just like, wow, it's so accessible.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay. Well, compared to like, okay, like a bottle of water over there was like 89 cents. And then so like a book is like maybe 30 cents, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's still more accessible than like anything like you look at over here. Like over here, a new book is like $20. A used book is like $15 or something like that. But over there, I was just like, wow, okay. So, wow, they want me to read. Okay, I will read. So I like bought a bunch of books. I think I bought like 30 of them. And I think the total came out to like almost $18. And I'm talking about like literature. I'm talking about like biographies, poetry, you know, just like all kinds of great. I even got an art book for like a dollar, less than a dollar. So I just think like there's a lot of like values that they're, you know, they're doing things right in some ways that we're not. And I wish when we came back over here, I felt bombarded by ads and like smells and different.
Yeah, just like something food. Being pushed on. Yeah
just like buy this cheeseburger, you know, wear this suit, you know, look cool, look this, look that. And I was just, that was the one thing that I missed, was like just being able to be alone with my thoughts, like walking down the street, you know, going to the Malarcon and just being like, this is just nice, just sitting here. And no one is telling us to move, and no one is paying, you know, having us pay for parking. You know, there's just like, it just felt nice.
Yeah, that's why I brought up the whole thing. Like, I wonder if like the way that, I guess what you guys experience, the you know, life slowing down, like the values being changed based on the perception that we have here with like material stuff. It's like, do you think this is like a product because of the political environment that they've been put in for over the last decades or so? Or because, you know, they have like these limitations that another country went ahead and set up for them, and that they kind of revalued those wants, those needs. The place looks like it's been frozen in place, at least from what I've seen, like the cars, the architecture of the buildings, like they hold this historic artistic value to it, you know, and just everything about it, at least from what I've seen in pictures, I've never been there. It looks like it's just old school way of living life. But again, because of those embargoes and all these political things that have been going on with them, I wonder if those are the reasons why that country has lived a different type of life. Well, I'm assuming it is, but I mean, you guys are the ones who were there, you know?
I don't know. I mean, it's a different way of life because old school, and you see these old school kind of things, but I don't think that like, if you were to take a time machine, go back to old school way here, it would still be very stressful. It would still be very like terrible. I mean, like it's really, it's a capitalist system. I mean, like we talk about not seeing people in the streets or being harassed by the cops. It's kind of interesting. A lot of people, when I came back, I told them that they're like, well, the Cuban government's very tricky. You know, they were hiding.
They're hiding the homeless.
Right. So yeah, they're hiding them in houses. But like, you know, like I don't really think that they were like, oh no, you know, Cedillo and Padilla are coming to our country. Hide the homeless. Yeah. They'll say bad things about us. You know, like we'll be too embarrassed if Cedillo and Padilla find out what's up, because they're poets. They'll write a poem about us, and then the jig will be up, and then you know we'll be exposed.
Yeah.
I don't think they were worried about us canceling them for having homeless. So I don't think that's what happened. But also, like, you know, where would they hide them, and how would they hide them? You know what I'm saying? So like, you know, like, and they're like, well, did you see other parts of the country? Well, if people were gonna be homeless, where would they be? You know what I mean? Have you ever been to New York City? Mm-hmm. Have you ever been to Chicago? Have you ever been to Los Angeles? Have you ever been in any major city in the country? You know, where do homeless people go? You know what I mean? Where do they go? Like, how would you hide the homeless in Los Angeles? Where would you hide them? You know what I mean? In LA, I mean, unless the Olympics are coming, they don't do that. I mean, like the Olympics coming, yeah. Well, then they'll hide them in, like, you know, they'll hide them in Venice or something like that, or wherever, you know, enter. But you know, they'll put people on buses and drive them out to Riverside or something. But like, you know, but how do you hide the homeless? You know what I mean? And they're saying like, well, you were only in Havana. That's where the homeless would be. Like, do you not live in cities? Do you not notice like downtown? I mean, like, what are you talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
are you talking about?
Few blocks down, and you see the homeless population.
Yeah, and it's the same in New York, and it's the same in Chicago, and it's the same in, like, you know, Minneapolis and Detroit. It's the same everywhere. So I mean, like, that is where the homeless would be if I were to see them. You know what I'm saying? So like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? If I were to see a homeless person like in a rural area, they'd be hitchhiking. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. You know, like, there's a homeless person in the countryside. It's somebody who's walking the countryside. What are you talking about? So, you know, so So people just make up all kinds of things. They want to be reactionary. But like, in terms of like what it is, I mean, it's the economic system they live under, and they appear anyways, far less stressed. And there's a shortage of stuff. You know, but that's the product of an embargo, you know?
So after you guys came back from there, are you guys planning on going back, or did you guys find that opportunity made more opportunities available to you guys after the fact?
Yeah, definitely. We were presented some opportunities to work with Casa de las Americas and get some stuff published. We are looking to be published by them soon, actually, in an anthology that they're going to put out, because they also have a press, and that's been around since the beginning also, and they put out books, and they have awards and things like that. So they're putting us on, which is really exciting. Super excited about that. And then I was also invited to go back this year for the Young Creators Conference, but I don't think that's happening anymore because of COVID.
Corona, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, we have a nice little bridge to Cuba, you know, a nice little working relationship with Casa de las Americas.
And that's
they're very much interested in us and in our work, and just, you know, we're just honored to be a part of the, as Cedillo said, all the legends that have come out of there. It's great.
Yeah, and that's awesome. I mean, because I mean, you know, when I first met you was what, like 2014, 15, around there, something like that. And
I was not going to Cuba back then.
Yeah, you were not going to Cuba. And, you know, everything, at least with Dryland, it was still kind of like, I believe you already had the issue out, but you were still kind of like working out the kinks, trying to publish, because I think you were doing a digital version online, right?
Yeah, I had just switched over to doing it in print. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, and after seeing that progression over the last few years, you know, because I've been following your social media pages, and every now and then you post something, so I have an idea of kind of what's the moving pieces that you have, and just to see it developing and grow to that point, it's been cool. You just seeing like, hey, you know, the books are being sold at LA County Library, or they're like at these whole different shops. I think that's awesome, and it's something that I love
Thank
seeing
you.
With the people that I occasionally, you know,
yeah.
sit down to talk with. because, you know, they're being consistent with their work. And especially you, you know, I would like to think you've come a long way in those.
I think I have from being like my story is pretty similar to Matt in that, like, I was in South Central feeling stuck, feeling like, where's my life going to go? You know, my dad had passed away. He didn't really leave us with anything. I was just unable to, like, really get ahead. You know, I just kind of felt like, wow, what am I going to do with myself? And dedicating myself to the journal and this project has really, 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 like, fulfilled me. I love doing it every day. You know, mm-hmm. I work hard at it. I don't skip any steps. I do the work. I make the connections. Like, I don't play games, you know, I'm not going around whining and crying and hating on people. I go around trying to help people if I can, yeah. If they're cool, you know, but like at the end of the day, like, I only work with certain people who I think are the dope people who I feel are also doing important work, like Matt mm-hmm. and Luis Rodriguez and some of the other people that I've been working with. These are people that, you know, I want to surround myself with. And the more I do that, the more the journal does better, you know, like the more it opens up opportunities for me and for mm-hmm. people that are in it. And it's just kind of taking a life of its own. So I'm just, you know, just taking care of it right now at this point, 5 years later.
Yeah. I want to kind of expand on something that Viva said, though. Like, it's really important that people understand this, that there's this kind of world that has kind of grown up on the internet for the last, like, I'd say 5-6 years. And that's not the real world. Mm-hmm. You can't act like that and be successful. You can't act like that and be successful. If I acted that way, I would not be where I'm at. If I acted like that and I was always looking to work with people who are more successful than me, who have gotten further than I have, and only to work with them, only to be like, complain about things and put them on blast publicly, then no one would want to work with me. I would not have gotten to where I am had I acted that way.
Same here.
And to people listening now, they will not get that. They will not get where they want acting that way. Viva doesn't act that way. I don't act that way. You know, like, we work with people and we take care of our friends and we make sure that, you know, like, keep each other working. We keep, you know, you help your friends out. You when you can, you put some money in your friends' pockets with shows and with whatever. And there's a reciprocity to it. But this idea that you're going to, like, somehow just, like, come up on the call out, it mm-hmm. doesn't work. It doesn't work. I mean, forget, like, if it's wrong or right. It doesn't work. You're going to get social media likes. But guess what? You're not going to get booked to colleges.
Yeah.
You're not going to be invited to speak at Casa de los Americas. You're not going to be invited to speak at Cambridge. You're not going to be invited back, as Viva's been back, but invited back to Casa de los Americas. You're not going to get a book published. You're not going to get anywhere doing that.
Yeah.
You're going to get nowhere. And you're certainly never going to work with me.
Yeah, definitely feeling that, Matt. Like, you're not going to work with me if you're in love with call out culture. If you believe that you can dispose of people, if you believe that, like, you can get ahead by, like, making up some bullshit and putting it on the internet, you know, like, nah, dude, we're here to do the actual work. We're out here, like, making moves every day. This whatever we do doesn't just happen overnight. Like, we're actually putting ourselves out there, doing the work. So anyone that tries to come over here and try to hate just because they're like, oh my God, you're doing so much better. Like, dude, like, I don't have time for you.
Yeah.
I don't have patience.
Yeah, it's just
I've come this far. I've come this far from zero, from having nothing, from my dad passing away and leaving me $0, leaving us with instability, you know, like almost losing my house and shit like that. Like, come on. I don't have time for bullshit.
Yeah, no, definitely no time for bullshit, especially when, you know, you've been so focused in what you're doing for this amount of time, like, to just have everything, in a sense, kind of like, taken out from underneath your feet just because one person doesn't necessarily agree, or they feel like, okay, I'm going to put Viva on blast, or I'm going to put Matt on blast. Like that, like you mentioned, that's not something that's going to get you anywhere. You know, it's not going to get the person who's saying that about, you know, whoever's talking shit about everybody else, they're not going to get nowhere. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, both of you guys have like this solid foundation of work and effort that you have under your belt that you can show, you know, and
credits. That's what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I really want people who are listening to us to understand, like, you can also be successful. Yeah. You can also dedicate yourself to something and, like, have something beautiful come out of it and have like a life that you want, you know, like go for it.
Yeah.
But like, be consistent. Don't work with those people who are going to take you down through a social media post. You know, work with people who are going to present opportunities to you and are going to challenge you and are going to teach you things.
Yeah.
That's where you want to be.
So. Yeah. I had like this example that happened a few days ago. I won't go into like the full details and stuff, but the idea of what was going on was that, I guess, like there was this, like it's like in a band scene, like music scene and stuff. But apparently there was like people in these certain bands that were like doing all this weird shit with like girls that might have been like underage and shit, like all this weird stuff. God. You know? And it's like, the reason that I started thinking about this was that they went ahead and posted all this stuff, examples of things that happened. And, you know, I was kind of just keeping updated because I don't want to like talk out of my ass on something that I don't really know a full story on. So the point is, I guess what happened in the scenario was a few hours later, you see that they took all the posts down, like of, I guess, what they were accusing these people of doing. And then they said something out and they posted up something on their story saying that they apologized because apparently some of the information that they were receiving was fake.
Yeah, I mean, so, that's what I'm talking about. You gotta like, if you're gonna say something about somebody, you gotta really be sure before exactly. You say something like that about somebody. Cause like, if that is true, then people need to like, you know, yeah, then they
need to know.
Mm-hmm. People need to know and they can't be part of the community. But like, if you're just posting it just because like you want to break the story on,
yeah,
you
exactly.
You want to break the Instagram story, and you know you can't, and then you have to turn around and be like, oh, I said the wrong thing. I mean, that's just
exactly.
That's
like I mean, by that time, I guess it depends what it is, but it may not be too late to be like, okay, repair the damage in a sense. But after the fact that you already said these things and now you're kind of backtracking on them, it's like, first of all, you lose all the I'm lost for words right now. My credit as a, I guess, fuck, what the fuck am I trying to say here?
Credibility.
There yes. You go. Jesus. Credibility. Yeah. So, you know, the credibility is gone, first of all, for the person who's reporting this. Like you said, they're trying to break the story because they're the first ones like, oh, I know this. So I'm going to say it. And then you have to backtrack. Not only is your reputation kind of already lost, but what damage did you do to that other person? Like,
yeah.
Like, you got to do all this, like,
And it's kind of a stain because like people want to believe the worst. So mm-hmm. It's kind of like, how do you even repair that? Because like there's going to be so many people who already took that information like, oh, these people are, you know, messing around with minors. They already took that information and left.
Yeah.
Like they're not going back and getting updated. They're just like, oh, that person is this.
Yeah.
So we got to be responsible, like, with what kind of information we're sharing, and
right,
it's like you can't just be putting yourself as like a judge and not know all the facts and not
exactly. Yeah, I mean, for sure, on my end, you know, if whatever those people think they claim that the other person did, by all means, if that did happen, hold those people accountable. But after the fact, once you know exactly what happened, instead of kind of just talking out of your ass and this whole cancel culture trying to.
But see, what you're describing, though, is a very serious thing.
Yeah.
Right? Definitely. A lot of the stuff, the cancel culture stuff, is not even the accusations are not even like, even if it were what you're saying, even if it were true, what are we even talking about? What are we even talking about? You know, like, I mean, I know, like, I don't know if people want to get into detail, but she just went through an ordeal that was completely absurd.
Yeah.
Completely, totally from start to finish, absurd. You know, like people wanting things that are just totally not part of like the common understanding. Like, I mean, it's ridiculous.
This past contributor just wanted me to like suddenly do all these things for her after I've already completed our deal. Like, she wanted a new contract. She wanted me to take down things from my website. And I'm just like, dude, why? You know, like, come on.
Yeah,
this isn't a good look. So, like, you look like you don't know how to do business.
So Eddie, imagine if like you post this up, right, and a year after you post this, wherever you're gonna post it, I were to hit you up and be like, Eddie, I demand royalties for my appearance on your show, and not only that, I want you to sign a contract with me a year after we already did the thing.
Yeah.
I want a retroactive contract with you so that I know you'll pay me these royalties that you've already paid me.
Yeah. It was pretty ridiculous. Like she's coming to me a year and a half, or like yeah, pretty much a year later, wanting a contract, wanting more of this, more of that, and just like, dude, I don't have time for this. I don't have time for this.
Now, do you think?
And I told her it's done. Like yeah, vete. Like I was like, dude, we're already done. We're done. But she doesn't want to stop.
Do you think this comes from like a point of like, because they see where you're at and what you're doing, that they kind of want to benefit from it? Or do you think it's more of a, like, I don't know, they feel like they learned their value in terms of who they are as a, I guess, person, contributor? Like, do you think of that, about that? Like,
you know, I don't really worry about it. Yeah. You know, vaya con Dios, you know? Yeah. Like if whatever her problem is, I don't care. I just want nothing to do with her. I'm never gonna work with people like that. Or I'm not gonna work with her ever again.
I don't know if people got them. Nobody gets paid to be part of an anthology. Like that doesn't happen. That's like that's weird. I don't even know what you're talking about. Like that's not or a journal. Like you don't get paid to, like, unless it's like it's not. That's not something that happens. I mean, you get paid, I guess, if you get published by like a newspaper or something like that, or maybe like Paris Review or something like that, you might get paid. But like the idea that you're going to get paid to be part of like a community journal, beyond just a couple books or beyond that, that's absurd. Like there's 30.
Yeah.
What would your royalties be? There's 34 contributors. What are you
25 cents in royalties?
What are you talking about? And so like that kind of thing is just that's the kind of thing that has to stop. It has to end. Because you're not going to get another opportunity like that. You know what I'm saying? You get an opportunity to get your work in the book. That book is actually in Casa Los Americas bookshop. So
it's in Cuba.
Her work's being seen, you know, in Cuba. But instead of being like grateful and like trying to like develop and nurture a relationship, it's like this kind of like desire to call out. And I think a lot of those people like that, they just really they overvalue where they're at, and they want things quicker than the process would allow. Mm-hmm. And they think that they can get that way. I don't know. They just want to act. They see things, or maybe it's like a lot of the you know, behind the scenes of like reality TV now. You know, like I remember, you know, like maybe like, you know, like when they used to have like those boxing series, and you'd see like the fighters getting ready for the fight or something like that, and you see how they'd act. And then nowadays there's a behind the music, so you can or behind this or behind the scenes, and everyone's always like filming their concert now, so you see like how like very famous wealthy people act. And you can see they act like shit.
Yeah.
And I think people see that and like, yes, I'm a talented artist too, so I will act like shit. Well, you know, those people have power. That's where they get away with acting like shit. You have no power. What are you doing? Yeah. And so I'm not even – and nobody should act like shit, like on the moral side. No one should act like shit. But like if you act like shit, you're not going anywhere. You know what I mean? You're not – you know, like,
yeah, you're just digging a hole for yourself.
You're
digging a hole for yourself, and you're not going to get out of it, and you're going to keep seeing other people move. Because they're easy to work with. People, you know, when people are easy to work with, I try to be as easy to work with as possible so that I can continue working, you know, and I'm only going to work with people who are easy to work with. So if we in the process of working together, I find out you're not easy to work with, I'm not going to work with you again.
Yeah.
And it's just as simple as that. And like, but I also know the other way is true as well. If I present myself as very difficult to work with, no one's going to want to work with me either. So like you have like this just it's a pretty simple concept, but I think that gets lost today in this day and age because of social media. People can click like I worked with so and so, and people are like, oh, I know that name, and they were trash. Oh, okay, angry face, right? Next thing you know, you got 450 reactions to saying someone that everyone recognizes is bad, right? And you think you did something, you think you accomplished something, you feel good, you get like an endorphin rush. Like, you know what's going to happen now for you? Like, that now that person's, like, not going to work with you. Their network's not going to work with you. No one's going to want to work with you. No one's going to want to work with you because they saw you do that.
Hey, I mean, that's how the thing is, people, I think, in the moment that they're doing it, I don't think they necessarily realize it until after the fact. Because, like you said, you know, they're doing this for, like, a little boost in the chemicals in their brain, you know? And the moment they do it, they're like, oh, yeah, it feels good. And next thing you know, it goes away. And then next thing you know, you become a full-on troll, you know? And it's like, where does that get you anywhere? You know, but
yeah.
I mean,
don't be a troll. Well, don't be a troll, guys.
I'm glad. Don't be a troll. I'm glad that just to see, you know, just the fact for at least Dryland, I'm glad to used to see that that's still going. I know we mentioned a little earlier that it's on its fifth anniversary this time around.
Yeah.
And I saw like some of the artwork that's
on
the book.
Cover art by Patrick Martinez.
Yeah.
Very dope guy.
Now is this issue, are you trying to like narrow it down to specific kind of like topics or like in terms of what's going on right now, or is it
When it comes to like the poetry and fiction, I try to be as free as possible, and as long as it's good, you know, I'll publish it. But when it comes to like the nonfiction, I try to, you know, get people to write things that are kind of relevant to some of the things that we're going through. So there's going to be some interesting pieces. But at the same time, I try not to stick too much to a theme, because I believe that like the issue just kind of comes together on its own. It creates itself. I don't try to like make it a certain way. So like, so the cover art was actually going to be something else, like two times before that, like it changed twice because, you know, first we were going through the pandemic, and then first we were going through nothing. So it was just like normal life under Trump, whatever. So we were going to do that. And then the pandemic hit and we're like, oh, we're going to do this. And then the George Floyd killing happened, and then all these other things started happening. So we're like, you know what? This is the most important moment right now. Yeah. And this is what we want to document, because we do see the journal as being a historical document. It's not just like existing in a vacuum of some sort. So we're very much like aware of where we're living and what times we're living in. So I really hope that this issue honors or documents that time. And even if it doesn't do a great job of synthesizing it or like making sense of what we're living, I want it to feel like as true to, you know, as true to this historical moment as possible. So, you know, there's going to be some things about it, and there's going to be some other things that are not related to it. There's going to be like a good mix of things in there, as always, you know, because a lot of these submissions were already chosen way before the pandemic hit and way before all these uprisings ever happened. So, yeah, so it's going to be good.
Yeah, I mean, and for you, Matt, I know you have a book. Were you saying that's about to be released, or it's in the it's already there. There you go.
It's already there. Yeah. Born in the Grass is out. You can get it at flowersongpress.com. Please go to flowersongpress.com. If that's difficult, you can find it at barnesandnoble.com. You can find it at walmart.com. You can find it at amazon.com. But don't give Jeff Bezos any money. Don't give the Waltons any money. Don't give Barnes or Noble or whoever owns that shit any money.
Yeah, who is it?
Flowersongpress.com.
Flowersongpress.
Yeah. Or you can actually go to Dryland, and they usually have copies of my book as well.
So. Yeah, I actually had an interview with Matt, and so you can find the interview and find his book. You can get to know Matt a little bit more about Mowing Leaves of Grass, which is a dope, dope, dope book. Everyone needs to read it, especially if you want to connect history to what's happening now. You got to read it. It's really going to help you make sense of all that.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to touch base on real quick. Go for it.
I just want to say, like, if when you do go to either flowersongpress.com or drylandla.org, if when you go to either one of those, shop around. There's some great books also. We got a lot of great press meets on Flower Song. And there's a lot of great other things to purchase there at the Dryland. You got other,
of course, pre-order. Yeah. Pre-order the issue that's coming out. Like, you guys get on it. It's coming out next, hopefully next month.
Like, I think Zoom didn't kick me out, so I think we should be still good. It looks, supposedly we were 53 minutes in, but you know, before we go end this, I kind of want to brief you guys both separately. Matt, I mean, in terms of the way that, you know, the content of your work, where does that usually come from? Like, what about your experiences have been put into your work? Like, where did that all come from?
I'm trying to find the thing. I have this thing called the three-act poem process, right? Mm-hmm. And I compose my poetry using this kind of model, right? Which I work to gather my thoughts. And on the one side, I have topic, details, points. And on the other side, I have act one, act two, act three. So on one side, I'm considering, what am I going to write about? What are the details I'm going to use? What are the bricks I'm going to use to build my house? And the last part is, what's my point? What am I trying to say here? Mm-hmm. On the other side, I have Act 1, Act 2, Act 3. So now that's where I organize my details to best service my point. So what I do with my poetry is I do a lot of research. I do a lot of research. I'm looking for key phrases. I'm looking for words that stand out. So I read articles. I watch documentaries. I watch interviews. I read books. I read passages of books. I'm like, oh, yeah. And what I'm looking for are little phrases that mm-hmm. come out that stand out, right? And so I'm going to take those standout phrases. Those are my details. I'm going to put them in an order to best facilitate whatever it is my point is, my general point. And then I'm going to organize them to what I call acts, Act 1, Act 2, Act 3. In Act 1, we world build. In Act 2, we have a problem to solve. In Act 3, we solve it or we don't. But when we don't solve it, it's a call to action to the listener to go solve it. So my process is very, you know, I approach writing poetry the way a carpenter would look at building a desk, or a car manufacturer would look at making a car. You know, I approach it like factory work. I approach it like a worker.
Nice. And now do you like decide, like, I guess, for example, like the current situation that we've been experiencing, like pandemic wise, like the protest, all this stuff, is that something that you on a personal level feel strongly about, like not just that in general, but like other topics? Is it something you feel strong about enough to write about it?
Well, of course, but like the way I tend to write would not be like, you know, I don't tend to do like a biopic kind of thing. Like I'm gonna write about, like, you know, the life of George Floyd or something, the ballad of George Floyd.
Yeah.
Like what I would more likely do is historicize it, right? So if I were to write about, you know, about the uprisings, I would look at it. I would trace it back, you know, and put it back in African American history, put it back in Black American history, put it back in the context from which it arises. So I would go talk about the Great Migration out of the South and into the North, and like what happened when people came into these cities that were supposedly, you know, better than the South, but all of a sudden you find them, like, you know, redlining and ghettos and areas where people are essentially, you know, locked out of the economy, and the uprisings of the past, and et cetera, et cetera. So I find the conditions that created the situation where you have these cities in what is supposed to be the more civilized or the better part of the country, the North, as it were, that still like are killing and murdering Black people, as the United States has done, you know, for its whole history. So I would look at that history and I would like try and put that within the context of that. So in the beginning, I would world build. In the middle, I would talk about George Floyd. In the end, I would talk about the rebellions, right? So in my mind, I would like conceptualize this thing. So that's how I would do it. If I were to talk about the pandemic more generally, I would look at like why it is, what is capitalism? Why is it that we can't produce enough masks? Why can't we produce enough ventilators? Why aren't these things in, why don't we have these in a stockpile? Why aren't these in some like warehouses that can be just brought out when we need them, right? So what is capitalism, right? Then I would look at like people dying and the effect of that. And then I would like call to action, like this is what we need to do. Actually, I wouldn't do it that way. I would talk about people dying, then I would describe capitalism, then I would call to action, right? So that would be the order I would put that in. Mm-hmm. So whatever it is, my mind is already trained to use these processes that I've developed over the years.
Damn, that's awesome. And I like for you, Viva,
he's
like
a machine.
when you started with the dry land, I mean, first of all, I mean, we party a little too late to get into that, but dry land in itself, in your description, what did that mean to you when you started that?
What did it mean?
Yeah, like what experiences that you have that say, you know what, this is what I'm gonna do, like this is,
well, it wasn't random, you know, like I've been making zines and making, even when I was a little girl, I would make little books, you know, like with glue and staples. And then once I got older, I started like getting old covers of old hardcovers of old books and taking them out, putting new paper in and typing things and stuff like that. So I've been like creating things like that since I was little. Yeah. And I just kind of like went from one thing to another, like started making zines, you know, then just kind of started going into an internship and then another internship and then learning about, you know, how to design, how to make books. So it was like a progress. It wasn't just like, oh, hey, I have a random idea. You know, it doesn't work like that, because like I wouldn't be as dedicated if it was just a random idea. Like this is something I've been doing for more than 10 years. So when people look at Dryland, they're like, oh, she's doing this out of nowhere. No. I've been doing this for like since even before high school. You know, and I knew that this was something I wanted to do. I was like, I want a literary journal. I want my own magazine. I want, you know, to write my poetry. I want to get published. You know, like I did, I willingly went down this path because I believed that this was what I was meant to do. This was what was calling me. And as I got older, I realized how important it was because I realized where I lived, and I realized like I'm in a ghetto, you know, like it's there's a lot of potential in the ghetto, you know. There's like a lot of life in it. There's a lot of hope. There's a lot of dreams. And I was like, you know what? This is where I'm from. I can't escape that. I can't be like, oh, I'm going to go off and live in Pasadena and start a literary journal there. No, I am from South Central. This is what made me. This is why I'm making a literary journal. Because me, myself, I was searching for a connection. I was searching for other people that I could connect to. And there wasn't that. And that's what poetry is. You're connecting to people at like this deeper level that cannot, that's like nurturing to your soul. So it's kind of like I felt like I was lacking that, so that's what I was looking for.
Damn.
So at the end of the day, it was still kind of like this basic need for connection. So you know, it's like we all have that basic need. Yeah, so no, I felt like the literary journal is a way to, you know, uplift myself first of all, and then the ghetto, and then South Central, and then the greater community and things like that. So that came later. And when I realized how important it was like, okay, well, it is a community thing because this is how it was. This is where I came from. This is where, you know, I'm sure there's so many other people that feel like me, that feel disconnected from the culture, from their own roots and things like that, even from their neighbors, you know? So I just wanted to bring something like that to life. And it's been a lifelong, well, semi-lifelong process.
And I think it's interesting to hear from both of you guys, because for anybody who's listening right now, you know, they may be in that place where they're like, I need to do something. I need to figure out what I'm in. Especially, I just turned 30 like a few months ago. So when I first turned 30, I was like, damn, what the hell am I doing? You know, I felt like an end-all situation. Like, fuck, I got to set my mind on something and I got to finish it. You know, I've been doing the podcast for a few years. I was doing the previous podcast before that. But, you know, the same, I guess what I'm trying to say is that when people see, like, let's say Dryland, or let's say your book, Matt, it's like people see like it's a product, but they don't see the struggle. And like you said, like the behind the scenes of how you got there, what you went through, you get to where you are now. They wanted like instant gratification type of thing. Like, oh, I have this idea to write this book. It's going to be done next month. I mean, I'm sure people could do it. But the whole idea is that not everything is done overnight. And people, a lot of the times, forget that that's reality. Like, you're going to have to be consistent with your work. You're going to have to push yourself. You're going to have to put yourself in uncomfortable positions at times to grow and continue doing this. And that's why I'm glad. I'm so happy to see that you're approaching your fifth year, or you are in your fifth year. Matt, it's the first time I actually like sit down and meet, talk with you and stuff, you know, but
yeah,
I had the chance to look up stuff online and see your poetry and see what you're about. And I think it's awesome that as just people who are coming from their community to try to open the eyes of those around us and kind of bring our experiences to the real, real world, because, you know, a lot of us are just kind of voiceless. I think it's just really cool to see this happening in different areas of, you know, our communities. But man, I don't even know what to say.
Thank you. You've done enough by having us on and sharing this platform with us, and we definitely appreciate you for that.
Thank you, guys. I wish we had a little bit more time. It's getting a little dark in this.
It's getting dark in your garage.
Yeah, this work. Yeah, I'm at work right now, but it's like getting really dark.
I was like, why is it dimming in there? Oh, it's like a big old door, huh? Or something.
Yeah, it's a big window in the front. It's the lights going out, and like it's starting to get a little creepy in here.
Yeah.
Here's what you should do. Set goals that you're young to achieve, and then you'll never feel old. That's what I'm doing. You know, I want to be known as the best political poet in America by the age of 40. Be widely known. Best political poet in America by the age of 40. So if I can accomplish that, that's young to be the best in the country at poetry, at political poetry, not poetry in general, but just political poetry. If I can get that recognition by the age of 40, I won't feel old when I turn 40.
Yeah.
Similar, you know what? You're right. I don't feel old either, because I love doing what I do. It just makes me feel like happy to be alive.
Yeah, there's like this extra pep in the work you do. Like, yeah, we're gonna get
yeah,
it done.
I get to read poetry and fiction and just edit people's stuff all day and tell them what I think. It's great.
Well, again, I mean, if people want to find your you guys' work, what are your handles? What are the best places to find your book? Find the your issue. I think it's the 10th issue or something, right? Issue 10?
Yeah, 10th issue. You can go to our website, drylandla.org. You can pre-order it there in our store. It's $35 for a bundle when you get a tote bag and a commemorative print and a beautiful cover and a dope, amazing writing. You can go to my Instagram. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Anochka, A-N-O-T-C-H-K-A. And you can also follow the press at Ponte Las Pilas Press on Instagram.
Nice, nice. What about you, man? Where can we people find your book?
You can go to, well, for me, you can go to mattcedillo.com. You can find me on Facebook and Instagram. You can find me, oh yeah, and for my book, go to flowersongpress.com, flowersongpress.com, or you can find it on Viva's site as well. So, and if you go to Flowersong, make sure to pick up, you know, some other titles there. I know David Romero just published a book there. Chris Munoz, a few other people, Edward, the proprietor of the whole thing, the runner of the whole show, and a few other really great poets are on there as well. So I would suggest checking out flowersongpress.com and checking out drylandla.org.
Yeah,
is that right? Drylandla.org, yeah, right?
You got it. Yeah.
And you go to Dryland, definitely pre-order the book. Pre-order yes. The next issue.
Yeah, pre-order the issue, buy Matt's book, buy Nicolai Garcia's book, The Assistant Editor. There's just plenty of stuff, like, on both of these websites. If you just connect with either of us, you're going to find books that you, like, wish you would have known about, and you're just going to order all of them. So just link up with us, and yeah.
Well, that sounds good. I mean, people know where to find you. People know about you now. And, I mean, again, thank you guys for taking the time for to speak, and I hope, you know, by the time your next issue comes out, Viva, hopefully we have you on the podcast again. Matt, same thing with you. I'd love to have you on the podcast sometime
soon. Hopefully there's no pandemic by then.
Yeah, and hopefully we all meet up face-to-face and, you know, embrace each other's embrace each other or whatever. Give us high fives or something.
Yeah.
When we meet in person, I'll do like a Toyota high five.
All right, you said it. And you're gonna hear the song in the back. I forgot. I was about to sing the Toyota theme song, but I forgot it. But
yeah, it's okay. We do.
You know what I mean. But yeah, thank you guys again. I'll keep in contact with you guys, and I'll keep you guys updated.
All right. Well, thank you so much for having us. Social
climbing. Yeah. Thank you guys, and we'll see you guys next time.
Late.